Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaka. Today, we are taking a look at some myths, legends, and lore that really influence our time. From old myths to newer legends, there's a lot to explore on this week's episode of Real College Podcast, which starts right now. Though we often think of myths and lores as something created long ago, really they're still being created today, just not where we might expect them. I'm talking about fan culture. From Marvel to Star Wars to Star Trek, modern mythologies are being made. Alex Schumacher sat down with a fan of all things Star Wars to learn about what all goes into being a dedicated Star Wars fan.
To do this story, I had to travel to a galaxy far, far away. Actually, I just had to drive down to Rochester, Minnesota, where I met with Jennifer Schubert, the PR officer for Central Garrison, a Star Wars costuming charity group that consists of around 150 members from Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Nebraska, and exists as a unit within the larger 51st Legion. Jennifer has two costumes that she breaks out, an Imperial officer and a Jawa. I asked her what all goes into the process of pulling together an accurate Star Wars costume, and she told me about how she built her Jawa costume and all the work she's put into her Jawa character.
To make my costume, I actually found the instructions on the Krait Clan forum, and I used monk's cloth, which I got on sale at Joann's, because thank goodness, it's really expensive. I had to dye it, so I had to learn how to dye fabric, which I'd never done before. I also had to learn how to sew, which I had never done that before either. I sewed all my costume up, figured out the electronics on how to wire the eyes. Then I started learning how to do the sounds that a Jawa makes. So I first started by just downloading the sound bank of Jawa noises that's available, and then I just kept practicing them. That allows me to interact with fans a little more than having it on a loop. If a little fan comes up to me and starts asking questions, I do not talk in my normal voice. I talk only in Jawa.
I asked Jennifer how she got into the business of costuming and becoming involved with Central Garrison and 51st Legion in the first place.
My husband is an even bigger Star Wars fan and went to a convention in Orlando, Florida in 2010. And he saw all these people dressed in costume, and he saw the R2 Builders Club. And he walked into this room full of R2s. He thought that they were just props, and they weren't. They were fan-made R2s, and he happened to say, oh, this is really nice of you to loan this, and same thing, kind of 501st. He'd heard about them, knew that they were costumes, but took a ton of pictures and said, I think we should do this. So then I decided when we were going to Anaheim for the next celebration, because I didn't go in Orlando, that I wanted to have a costume and I wanted to get approved. So I thought, what can I do to get approved and what costume would I want? Well, I love Jawas. I love Ewoks. I love Biker Scouts. I wasn't ready to tackle armor. So I decided to go with a soft costume that I thought I could get approved before the celebration in Anaheim. So that's how I decided, and I connected with my local Central Garrison. Somebody said, yes, this would be great. Here's how you do it.
Once Jennifer made her costume and got it approved by the 51st, she was able to start going on troops. Troops are when members of the 51st show up to what's usually a charity event in costume and interact with members of the public.
My first troop was a Boy Scouting event, and then the next troop I did was at Celebration in Star Wars Celebration, and I did a Make-A-Wish event for a kid on the floor of this huge convention center in Anaheim for a Make-A-Wish, and we did a presentation, and it was fantastic, and I have done about 75 troops since then.
Doing these volunteer events is really what 51st is all about. Sure, it's fun to dress up like the characters, but going out and helping the community lies at the heart of the mission. And as Jennifer explains, these charity events can make a big impact.
We also do children's hospital troops, and that is my favorite kind of troop. I'm a nurse. I'm not a pediatric nurse, but I hate seeing sick kids. And the best thing that you can do is go and visit these kids in the hospital. We go to two different hospitals here in Minnesota. We go to the Children's Hospital up in Minneapolis, and our members do what's called the Dude Show. And they ask questions, then they get to interact with some of the kids afterwards. And that's been a lot of fun for a lot of our characters. And then the other hospital we go to is St. Mary's Hospital at the Children's Hospital. Typically, we'll walk into a big area and they'll bring the kids to us that are able to. And we'll just play with the kids. The kids come, they take our blasters, they shoot us, they play lightsabers with our Jedis, and then we'll sit down and color with them, we'll play games. We tend to like to bring coloring books, puzzles. I personally go to the dollar store and buy whatever Star Wars coloring books and puzzles they have. And that way that gives them something to have to do after we leave. For the kids that we can't come down, we'll go to their rooms and come in and say hi, take a picture, smile, give them a hug, high fives. You're seeing kids that are battling cancer, that are battling amputations, a variety of things. And for that moment, they're a kid. One of my best stories I have to tell is not from one that I did, but my husband's first hospital troop. He brought our R2. It was one of the very first outings our R2 went on. They'd finished, had a great time. We're just finishing, getting ready. Everybody had taken off their costume. And the coordinator came and said, hey, we have this kid that's in the ICU, and we really think it'd make his day. Is there a couple troopers that wouldn't mind coming? One of the other guys got dressed. My husband went with his R2. This little kid, small little child, was on a ventilator. He looked at R2, and he couldn't talk because of the ventilator. He signed something to his mom, and his mom immediately started cracking up. And my husband's like, what did he say? And he goes, vacuum cleaner. He called R2 a fancy vacuum cleaner and asked if the vacuum cleaner could go for a walk with him. Well, what's my husband going to say? Of course R2 can go for a walk. So the little boy held on to R2 and looked at him constantly with his blinking lights and beeping light noises and went for a walk around the hospital with him. Got back to his room and said, I gotta go. Therapy's here. Bye. And then signed thank you to my husband. His mom said thank you. That was the first time he'd smiled in 3 weeks. That's why we do these troops. If I can make a kid smile, you know, that is the biggest joy. And that's why I troop.
From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
All societies tell stories. It's a way of making sense of the world, creating individual identities, and also of creating a collective identity. This holds true for the epically long prose stories of Viking Age Scandinavia known as sagas. These sagas were created in a period of turmoil to describe the changes occurring and also create a new structure for the changing society. Today, they give us a glimpse of what life was like for 13th century Scandinavians. Liv Riggin sat down with Professor Lena Norman to discuss the function of Icelandic sagas.
I'm Lena Norman. I'm the senior lecturer in Swedish in the Department of German, Scandinavian and Dutch. And I have a PhD in all the Germanic literatures and languages. So Viking Age is the focus of my research.
The first thing that comes to mind when Icelandic sagas are brought up might be the adventure tales of dragons, gold and danger. But these are only one of many types of saga.
You have the mythic heroic or the legendary sagas, there are the family sagas, there are the king sagas, the bishop sagas, and they all tell about the time of the settlement or even before the time of the settlement of Iceland. The legendary sagas don't take place in Iceland, they take place in Europe. And the king sagas and the bishop sagas is in a later time period. They are all written down in the Middle Ages, so we don't have any written sagas from the time period of the Viking Age. It was oral storytelling at the time, people would meet in the evenings, and you would have a skilled storyteller who would just tell the story, so everyone would know the stories. They are built up with little bricks, you could say, for memory, how to remember the story. The oral storytelling part could be filled in with visual components, or poems, for example. So if you would sit and you would see that the audience would respond well, you could just ornament the story more and really get things going.
Sagas were commonly interpreted and accompanied by visual representations as well. The oral and visual were interwoven, sometimes literally.
To the Saga of the Volsungs, for example, we have a rock carving of this saga in Sweden. It's from about 1040. There are wood carvings, carved church doors from Norway, also representing the same saga. It's clear. And then we have woven tapestries from the northern part of Sweden, also dated to exactly the same time period. So if you look at the smaller micro-narratives in this, it's a visual narrative.
These visual narratives were often created by women, since they were barred from participating in the oral histories.
Women did not own the right to the public word. Men would tell the stories, women would listen to the stories, they could not sit around the fireplace, they would be in the background, and they would gather in the kitchen the day after, for example, to do their daily chores, and they would retell the stories. But they would focus on maybe not the killing of the dragon, the swords, the gold. They would think about the stories about love, damaged honor, deceit, revenge, and more family-oriented.
It's everyday stuff, rather than the monsters and adventures. These sagas participate in myth-making in that they tell the origin story of Iceland. The family sagas both describe and participate in the making of a social structure, out of the many small, fragmented groups of Scandinavian free farmers leaving to stake a claim in Iceland.
I'm describing a daily life of farmers, the harvest, how to go on trips to try to get timber back to Iceland, for example, or try to get to Norway and get training with the kings and then come back and being more sophisticated, which was something young men were supposed to do. So it's more about the daily life and how to keep your farm going and maybe consolidate your land with the neighbor's land and keep peace. So for the later sagas, the family sagas about the Icelanders, about the settlement, the genealogy is very well recorded, so you can go back. And that's what the Icelanders did. They could trace their ancestors back, but they would get historical information and real people and where they lived and so forth. So you have also annals, which are an annual description of life in Iceland at the time. In Icelandic, they are called Íslendingasögur, which means the sagas of the Icelanders. So they're telling the story of the Icelanders. The time of the settlement, why did people leave Norway, and where did they settle in Iceland, and how the structure of Iceland came about.
The consolidation of power occurring in Scandinavia at the time was a major factor in the settlement of Iceland.
It is also a time where you have a consolidation of power, so you have free farmers, and suddenly you have a chieftain with more power, starting to take land from the free farmers, the odal. So people are leaving a society where you have suddenly someone with more power. So it's really the pyramid with the slaves, the free farmers, and then the chieftain at the top. And the ones who objected to that decided to leave. So this is Norway, and then go west because they had heard rumors about this, you know, empty land to the west. So they would leave Norway, they would come to the Shetland Islands, go on to the Faroes, and then eventually end up in Iceland, which was a free, empty land. There is no evidence for this island to have been settled before, and they are going to a society where there is no state center. So it's called a free state period. So you don't have one person who is in charge. So you have to come up with a system. How is this going to work?
Not only was the class structure of Scandinavia changing and the society of Iceland forming, but Christianity was also spreading throughout Europe.
And then in some of the family sagas, you can read about the conversion to Christianity, which was peaceful in Iceland. There are some representations that you can see that the idea of Odin, for example, is present with an eight-legged horse and his two ravens, the tree of life where the gods would meet every day. So, yeah, it's really about the legendary saga sits before the conversion, and then you can see the entire conversion span in the other sagas. Officially, now we are Christians, but then you can go home and you can sacrifice and you can do whatever you want. So you would have the two faiths existing at the same time.
In addition to having this function as narratives making sense of enormous cultural change, these sagas are also just good reads, according to Dr. Norman.
These stories are really fantastic reading still, and to tell the stories, and I'm very fortunate to be able to teach a class about these stories.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Liv Riggins.
Legends are usually passed down in a nicer, more children-friendly way than they were originally told. Sophie Dolan tells us a story of a lesser-known legend from Scotland which has a pretty dark side.
The daunting lochs and mystical wilderness of the Scottish countryside had mythical beasts like nowhere else in the world. Many people know about the lake-dwelling monster, Nessie, that inhabits Loch Ness in the Scottish Highlands. But fewer know about the shape-shifting water spirits known as kelpies. Kelpies lurk around banks of bodies of water and lure unsuspecting people to ride on its back, eventually leading them down to a watery grave. Characterized by its dripping mane and magical aura, kelpies are most attracted to children who know no better than to suspect anything suspicious with the beast. There are various explanations of what happened to children after they find themselves face to face with a kelpie. Capturing and killing is one of them. On the other side is the slightly more kid-friendly version, in which the kelpies lead the children away from their parents, off into the sunset, never to be seen again. Kelpies are known to be seen in multiple forms, the most common being a lake-dwelling monster slithering through the sea, a beautiful young woman, or as a pony. According to the Scottish Storytelling Center in Edinburgh, the best way to fend off a kelpie is to grab its bridle. Grabbing its bridle will leave it paralyzed. This will leave you in a position of power over the kelpie, which will help when you go to tame it in the future. Because once you have command over one kelpie, you have command over any kelpie you come into contact with. If you want to stay on the safe side while visiting the Scottish Highlands, stay away from rivers and lochs when it is thundering, as that is the time that kelpies are most likely to hunt for prey. But you can visit the kelpies in Falkirk, Scotland, where two 30-meter-tall steel sculptures of the beasts reside. The biggest equine sculptures in the world, in fact. You can also learn about kelpies from a safe distance through the works of Scottish authors Robert Burns and J.K. Rowling. For Real College Podcast, I'm Sophie Dolan.
In 2013, a man named John Negroni published a blog post explaining the fact that all Pixar movies exist within the same universe and on the same timeline. The blog post went viral, and Negroni even wrote a book about it called The Pixar Theory. Most people who have seen a Pixar movie would be able to point out the fact that certain things appear in multiple movies. For example, the Pizza Planet truck. But Negroni took this a lot farther than most people did. The timeline begins with the movie Brave, where magic is first introduced into the Pixar universe in the form of the Will of the Wisp. They're the little blue floating things that Merida follows to the witch's house. That magic is what leads to superheroes, which is where the Incredibles come in. The Incredibles introduces two essential things into the Pixar universe: self-serving machines like the Omnidroid, and something called zero-point energy. That zero-point energy is where toys get their energy, which leads to Toy Story. Toy Story is the first time we see sentient objects that come up with their own rules and societies. They try to find a purpose in life. They also learn why being away from humans can be harmful. In the second Toy Story, Jessie even feels resentment towards people. That then leads to Finding Nemo. Just like toys, fish have very complex social lives, and they also hold a lot of resentment towards humans for polluting the environment and putting them in cages. But it's Ratatouille that provides the first instance of animals controlling humans. Remy controls Linguini, and the tension between animals and humans grow. The rat colony hates the humans. That then leads to Toy Story 3, where again, we see toys resenting humans more than ever before. Lotso, who was himself discarded, starts to fend for his own kind.
What? You want your mommy back? She never loved you. Don't be such a baby!
We also see the introduction of By and Large, which is a company that plays a big, big role in the Pixar theory. The next movie we go to is Up. In Up, Carl is forced to give up his house to By and Large. He travels down to South America where he meets Charles Muntz, who has an army of dogs. This is the first instance of animals talking to humans.
Speak!
Hi there!
Did that dog just say hi there?
Oh, yes!
Bruh!
My name is Doug.
These animals are not happy to be in captivity and being controlled like that, so a war breaks out. But the animals are all killed off by machines that humans had created. Humans decide to leave Earth on the Axiom. In their absence, cars take over. We know for sure that they're on the same planet as humans were, because in Cars 2 we see Tokyo and parts of Europe. But there isn't enough oil to sustain the cars, so eventually they die out too. If the Cars part of the series seems a bit far-fetched and odd, wait until you hear about WALL-E. WALL-E is the only robot to have survived because he's so fascinated by humans, which drives home this idea of machines needing humans. The theory then says that WALL-E is a robot Jesus, which sounds ridiculous, but there is justification. WALL-E and Eve, which by the way is no coincidence of a name, work together to get a plant to the humans and save the human race. In the end, they plant a seed which will eventually grow into a mighty tree, which leads to A Bug's Life. The tree in WALL-E becomes the focal point in A Bug's Life. Bugs have complicated societies and they even live longer than they used to. They say they have survived entire summers, and one of the bugs even says she feels like she's 90. There aren't many humans around to threaten them, but they are there. There's still a lot of radiation from By and Large, and that leads the animals and bugs to mutate into monsters. That leads to Monsters University. Monsters are taught that humans are toxic and dangerous, which leads to the energy shortage in Monsters, Inc., because monsters have just stopped interacting with humans at all. But the thing that ties it all together is Boo. Boo loves Sully, or Kitty, which is what she calls him, so much that she spends the rest of her life trying to find him. She uses the Will of the Wisp to travel through doors to find her kitty. She is the witch from Brave. There's even a scene in Brave where you see Sully carved into a piece of wood. It's also the reason why Merida tries to enter the witch's home and there's nothing. The doors need energy or magic to be able to open to different places. Now, as far-fetched as some of that may seem, it's an interesting theory nonetheless. Pixar writers have refuted the theory, claiming that this would have taken way too much foresight. But there's definitely something to be said about the Easter eggs in the movies. That is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Alex Schumacher, Liv Riggins, and Emily Allen. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in every Monday for more arts and cultural coverage.